From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Green Party of Texas is back on the ballot. How did this happen, and why did Republicans work so hard to make that happen? Segregation at Longview ISD, how Brown v. Board of Education still cast a shadow over Texas. And Dominicana, the story of immigration in the U.S. in the 1960s. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas has never been accommodating for third parties in their efforts to win votes. The Libertarian Party has traditionally been perceived as taking votes away from the Republican Party and the Green Party from the Democrats. But in the last legislative session, with the passage of HB 2504, it seems like the bill was passed and signed into law to make it easier for the Green Party to get on the ballot and make it more difficult for the Libertarians to get on the ballot. It all comes down to the upcoming election cycle and concerns of a follow-up blue wave. It seems like some thought that some green on the ballot could save some red seats. Nevertheless, Green Party officials say they are happy to have an opening to appeal to Texas voters, and they dispute the thinking that they are spoilers. Alfred Molson is the male co-chair of the Green Party of Texas.
Good fortune, misfortune, I don't know, something like that. We are back on the ballot, and hopefully we will have more of an opportunity to present our ideas to the public and get a chance to get elected to a public office. And if we don't get elected to public office, at least we will get the ideas out there that are pro-environment, addressing climate change, improving the economy for everyone, and creating good jobs as opposed to just jobs, and also ending these horrible wars that we're involved in all over the world.
Why were you off the ballot? How long have you been off the ballot?
After 2016, we did not get the magical 5% that you need to get for a statewide public office. Therefore, that means that we were off the ballot and we had to collect about 84,000 signatures of Texans who were not going to vote in the Democratic, Republican, or Libertarian primaries. And it's like that for any third party in the state of Texas.
And when you said the magical 5%, is that you're alluding to that this was some sort of arbitrary number that they cooked up?
Exactly. Exactly. There are a series of tripwires if you are on the ballot, your political party. In other words, you have to get 5% each time that they have a gubernatorial election, 5% of the statewide vote if you have a statewide candidate. Let's say somebody runs for attorney general or Texas Railroad Commission or something like that. You know, that person has to get 5% of the vote statewide. And if they don't, that means that the entire political party is off the ballot. And then you have to collect 1% of the voters have to sign a petition to allow you to get back on. That is 1% of the people who voted for governor of Texas. And the higher the turnout, the higher the number of voters who have to sign your petition. And then the voters have to be people who are not going to vote in the Democratic, Republican, or Libertarian primary. So it's a big old series of hurdles and tripwires and mazes that are designed to keep the people of Texas from being able to vote for any sort of third party.
There's also the passage of HB 2504 in the last legislative session, and does that make it easier to get third parties on the ballot?
No, it does not. It's interesting. It's like we didn't actually lobby for the thing. I mean, you know, I'm glad that we're on there. I'm glad that we have the opportunity to go in front of the Texas voters, but we didn't lobby for the thing. Here's what happened. It was specifically tailored to allow the Green Party to be on the ballot. And the Republicans imagined that our mere presence will mess with the Democrats. Apparently, the Republicans are being messed with by the Libertarians, so they want somebody to mess with the Democrats. Now, of course, the fact is that people who would vote for the Green Party are different from the people who would vote for the Democratic Party. And a lot of people wouldn't vote at all if they did not have the option of having the Green Party on the ballot.
It's your view that you do not take votes away from the Democrats. It's your view that you bring new voters to the polls.
Correct. Correct.
Now you're on the ballot. Now what?
Well, right now, unfortunately, because there's still some rules that are on there, just to become candidates, you have to either pay a filing fee, which would be about $5,000 if someone was going to run for U.S. Senate. And there are other amounts, like $3,000 if you're going to run for some other state offices, statewide offices. And even if you're going to run for something like county constable or state representative, you're still talking about several hundred dollars. Or you can get signatures from people who are not going to vote as a Democrat, Republican, or Libertarian. And it's still onerous. And if we don't make the magical 2% statewide, you know, then eventually we'll be off the ballot again. And we're still going to face the same 84,000 signature rule if we're not on the ballot again.
So you're on the ballot for 2020.
Yes.
You have to have candidates.
Yes.
Where are you on figuring out who's going to be your candidates?
Right now we have 17 people who have talked about being on. I'd say seven of them can either afford the filing fee or they are able to collect the signatures. The rest of them, though, those filing fees are pretty onerous, pretty expensive, and, you know, we don't have any sugar daddies out there. You know, I've been waiting for my check from George Soros to arrive. He keeps putting me off.
Mm-hmm. So was this a building year for the Green Party?
Absolutely. This is building year. This is the opportunity to show our stuff but more specifically to get the ideas out there. You're not going to hear this stuff from the Democrats. You're not going to hear this stuff that we promote from the Republicans. You know, it's like every single person who's a member of the Green Party has been absolutely horrified by what's occurring at our borders. You know, the torture and the concentration camps that are going on with people who want to legitimately file for asylum or simply to legitimately immigrate. It's horrible. You know, we condemn all those human rights violations that our government is engaging in. That's not helping immigrants. That's not helping Americans. And to spread our ideas and to hopefully stop the endless war and basically to save us from the climate disaster, which is unfolding, which is human caused. That's what we're about. And that's what we're trying to promote.
Sure.
And also basic reform, like end the corruption, you know, end the corporate ownership of our government.
Everything you just said, I've heard leading candidates for the Democratic Party say the same thing. But you mean it. Is that the difference, is that you mean it?
Not only mean it, but we aren't taking money from the wealthy people. We aren't taking money from the corporations. We aren't taking money from some PACs where everybody's hiding who they are behind the money. You know, behind the some name of, Texans for Good Stuff, you know, which might be funded by some big coal interest or oil and gas interest or casino interest or something like that. We're not taking any money from those people. So it's like, okay, the Democrats might talk reform. They might hint at improvements or changes. When it comes right down to it, they're going to go with their donors. And their donors are big corporations and wealthy people.
Why do you think that HB 2504 was passed in the last legislative session by the Republicans?
Well, it's pretty obvious. The Republicans are thinking that just by having the presence of Green Party candidates, somehow we're going to mess with the Democrats. You know, we're going to peel off some percentage or something and keep the Democrats from coming back, since the Republicans have messed up so badly. But that's just not the case. It's simply not the case. There are more people who will show up who would never show up to vote for Democrats. They'll show up to vote for Greens. Also, there are people who, you know, they might vote for Democrats, but it's like a small percentage would actually switch votes to the Greens.
These elections are going to be swung on small percentages. Taking away 2% of voters who would vote for a Democrat and having them vote for the Green Party may not sound like a lot, but it could be enough to give a victory to a Republican.
So basically what you're saying is that giving people the option to choose candidates who they actually believe in, who are actually going to work on their in their favor, is somehow wrong?
No, I didn't say that at all. But
I know. It's just that's basically what's underlying the Democrats' arguments against us. You know, it's like, okay, you really don't want to give people a choice. You don't want to allow democracy. You don't want freedom of speech. I mean, that's basically what they're implying. I mean, you know, and you're not implying that, I know, but I'm just kind of like, you know, these guys don't want democracy. They don't want real freedom. They also don't want people to have a real choice. You know, they can get us boxed in where they can say, well, we want good things. We want positive things. We want to reform. And then once they get elected office, they don't do anything because they're just following the big money. Okay. They're following their corporate donors, their wealthy elites, and things just get worse. And, you know, the minute you say, well, look, we elected you to reform. We elected you to change things and improve things, and we're going backwards. Well, we're not as bad as the crazy Republicans out there. You know, it's like, well, that's not helping us. You know, it's like, what good does it do if you get elected and you don't do anything good for us? You know, that's the problem there. If they have no competition, if they are not going to walk the walk, they may talk the talk, but if they don't walk the walk, what good are they?
Do you think that having you on the ballot will make the Democrats be serious about these issues, knowing that if they don't, that the Green Party will become a problem for them? You hold them honest.
That is the hope. That is the intention, or at least that's part of our intention. Now, we are a separate party. We have separate ideas from them. We want to end all these wars. We want to actually make sure that all the jobs that are created by restructuring our economy so we aren't polluting as much and destroying our climate, destroying our world, that these things get actually implemented. And just because they reform a little bit doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing the right thing, you know, overall. I guess I'm just deeply critical of the Democratic Party. They hint at good things and then they don't do much of anything. And they're more in alignment with the Republicans than they are with the American people. It's just my hope that we get better, whether they reform themselves or not. You know, we're going to be there to promote and act on the better ideals of humanity, whatever the Democrats do.
Alfred Molson is the male co-chair of the Green Party of Texas. In East Texas, the Longview Independent School District is moving forward now that a federal court has released it from decades-long supervision connected to its history of racial segregation. Some argue that true integration never came to Longview ISD, and there remains barriers for Black and Hispanic students, while white students have access to better opportunities for academic success. But the district is pouring millions of dollars into new programs to correct that. But if it's going to continue that policy of student equity, it all depends solely on which way the school board leads. The issues are explored in a new podcast called Disintegration by the Texas Tribune and the NPR program 1A. Aliyah Swaby is a reporter for the Texas Tribune.
In 2018, Longview ISD got released from a federal desegregation order that had been placed on them in 1970. So they'd spent 48 years working through a long process to desegregate their schools, make sure Black students, white students, and a newer population of Hispanic students and growing population of Hispanic students had the same opportunities to learn and to achieve, and they were released from that just recently.
And had conditions really improved to the point where releasing them from this court supervision, did that make sense?
I think if you look at a lot of metrics, and if our ideal is we want every student to have an equal opportunity, then no, then, you know, they did not achieve that. They did get further on that than other districts, arguably because of the court order. You know, they were forced to look at their statistics on discipline and their statistics on, you know, how many students of each race were allowed to be in the gifted and talented programs, and were actually provided those opportunities. But in the end, you still have, you know, Black and Hispanic students not being college ready at the same rates as white students are college ready, not being in advanced courses as much as the white students in the district are.
So as you say, it was 1970 that Longview ISD was put under court supervision to comply with Brown v. Board. That decision happened in 1954. What happened in between 54 and 70?
So a lot of school districts, not just Longview, but all across Texas, there was a concerted state-led effort to resist. There's a report that's out there from, you know, just after Brown v. Board passed, signed by state leaders, where they're really giving advice on how do we avoid integrating our schools? How do we keep a dual school system for as long as we can, and not integrate despite this federal order to this federal court order to do so. And so in between 1954 and 1970, there were school districts that voluntarily integrated. There were some in Bexar County that were early integrators, but then you have Longview ISD and a lot of districts in the north and east of Texas that just said no and refused to do it until an East Texas federal judge started the process of this series of desegregation orders, forcing a lot of the state school districts to integrate.
And when that order came down in 1970, how did the public react?
So in Longview, you have a very violent reaction. Right before they were supposed to start busing Black students to the formerly white schools, there was a bombing of the bus barn. Two white men who opposed integration set off dynamite at the bus barn in order to protest. They also, there was a group of people who went around and set off dynamite at the house of a Black woman who lived in a white neighborhood. So you see it wasn't just that people were, you know, grumbling about this, in their own homes, but they were actually being violent toward the Black people in their community.
So why are you looking at this today?
Well, I think you see today a lot of inequality. You see an achievement gap and really an opportunity gap where Black and Hispanic students still don't have the same results, but also the same opportunities as white students in Texas. And, we think it's important to look at the history. So you can't look at this disconnected from, you know, the state and school leaders actually resisting providing those opportunities to students for years.
So people, are they thinking that this was working, that relieving Longview ISD from this supervision, did that work, according to activists and people who are concerned about this?
I think the problem when you lift a court order is that the school board is the whole body ultimately responsible for making sure that these inequities disappear. And if the makeup of the school board in Longview changes to where that's no longer a priority for them, then you could just, you know, regress and you could have a school district that has actually widening inequality instead of, you know, shrinking inequality.
Then it could slip back to pre-1970 conditions.
Exactly, right. You could create a system that's, or allow for a system that's more unequal than it had been under the court order.
Aliyah Swaby is an education reporter for the Texas Tribune and part of a team producing Disintegration, a podcast with the Texas Tribune and the NPR program 1A, which focuses on Longview ISD and its efforts to topple barriers for students of color. Angie Cruz is a New York-born novelist, editor, and professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh. Her latest novel is Dominicana and was inspired by her mother's story as an immigrant in the U.S. in the 1960s. The protagonist, Anna, is a teen bride married off to a man twice her age who takes her from her small village in the Dominican Republic to New York City. She is forcibly cast into unfamiliar spaces, made all the more inhospitable because of his treacheries. Anna comes of age in these lonely situations, using her strength and her intelligence to find her own way as an immigrant in America. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides spoke to Cruz about the novel.
The story was inspired by my mother in the way that she also immigrated to the United States at the age of 15, married to a man twice her age. However, she came in the 70s. So even though the novel was inspired by my mother, it was also inspired by what she didn't want to talk about. And as you know, because you're also a Latina writer, there's a lot of ways that we know that our mothers and grandmothers and elders in our family have gone through a lot and they don't want to speak it. So what I was interested in writing the book was thinking about all the things that we don't say about our experience. And that, in the end, was my true inspiration.
All the things that we don't say. And so what does your family make of this book now, though? Because if they're feeling that same way about being very private, about there are certain things you don't say, de la familia, what's been the response from the family?
Well, what's been incredible, first of all, the book is in English, and most of my family speak Spanish, so, or read in Spanish. So until it's translated, I think I'm going to be saved from some of the feedback. But it was really important for me that my mother read the book, because in the end, I ended up fictionalizing. It's a novel. It's un puro cuento, right, in that way. And because there was so little that I could get from actual stories, I decided to write a novel and to go into the archive. And I also decided to write about a different time period than my mother was in New York City. So she was in the city. My family came into the city in New York City in the 70s, but I set the book in the 60s. So the book is set in 1965. It was the same time that the U.S. occupied Dominican Republic. It was the year that Malcolm X was assassinated right across the street from where I grew up. And when my mother read the book, she was surprised at how many details I got right about the city that she remembers before gentrification, before there was like a large Dominican population living in it. She also understood that this was fiction. And it was very sweet because she finishes the book and she goes, you know, Angie, I think this is the best book you've written yet.
Wow.
And I thought, that is the blurb I want in my book.
That's the
blurb.
Mom
says she likes the book.
That's so wonderful. I have to ask you this about your novel. In 2019, here we are with so many facets of life where it feels like we're regressing in terms of social equity and issues of justice. Mm-hmm. How is this novel about this teen bride from the Dominican Republic, this immigrant story by a writer who's a woman of color, daughter of immigrants, received not just by your family, but what's been your sense out there from the reading audience that you've encountered so far?
I think first, so many women that I've met have been really excited to see themselves in the book, right? Especially Latinx women, Dominican women. But what's been most surprising about the feedback that I'm getting of the book, I think that initially, you would say, okay, this is a story about immigration. And immigration, obviously, is like, it's definitely present in my mind, thinking about what's happening on the border and the vulnerability of all these children in particular, right, who are being detained for so long and mistreated. So I thought, oh, this book could resonate to people who are thinking about these issues or maybe open their hearts to young people immigrating. But what I found through in the past few weeks, as I've been getting feedback from the book, from readers, is that the book is really resonating with women who are women themselves who have survived some kind of abuse or domestic violence situation, or who are sisters or daughters or cousins or friends with women that they understand may have gone through some kind of experience but haven't been able to talk about it. So what I found, I was just in North Carolina in Winston-Salem, how many women bought the book for their sisters, their friends, their mothers, even men who bought the book because they were like, I need to talk about this.
You can think about the issue of family separation at the border during mm-hmm. this immigration crisis that we're all witnessing. And in light of the things that you know that happened to your mother and happen all the time, I mean, almost with impunity, it seems. And when people protest, it doesn't seem to stem the tide in the current immigration crisis. But I was thinking while you were talking about how your mom came in the 70s, it's set in the 60s, and all of these important events that happened in history during that time. And yet what's coming through for people is this other story about women. And that's a story of today as well.
Could this book be resonating in the same way if it wasn't for all the political movements that we are now, like the political movements like the Me Too, like Time's Up, like We Need Diverse Books, like Black Lives Matter. If it wasn't for all these movements started by women mm-hmm. around raising visibility around the fact that we don't have enough representation in literature told by writers of color, if we weren't in the moment of Me Too, where we're now starting to talk about, you know, patriarchy and misogyny at work and women's rights in a very different way, would people be ready to read this book in that way, right? Like, they might have read it in a different way. But I think we're in a moment in history right now where women are very ready to talk and want to talk about their story. And in fact, like when we were talking about secrecy and the women in my family, I think my mother would say, oh, pero eso son cosas típicas. You know, why do you want to talk about something that happens to everyone or feels like it happens to everyone, right? Dealing with the fact that we live in a misogynistic culture. And I don't mean just in Latino communities. I mean all communities. I think that now that the book is out, like her response, and it's not, and it's a response that I've seen of a number of people that have been reading the book. They're like, well, yeah, you know what? It's messed up what's happening with women. We need to talk about it. And that's very exciting.
Angie Cruz is the author of Dominicana. It's published by Flatiron Books. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.